CEOs of every major Wall Street firm were also on the wrong end of the gamble. All of them, without exception, either ran their public corporations into bankruptcy or were saved from bankruptcy by the United States government. They all got rich, too. What are the odds that people will make smart decisions about money if they don't need to make smart decisions, if they can get rich making dumb decisions? The incentives on Wall Street were all wrong. They're still all wrong. But I didn't argue with John Goodfriend. Just as you revert to being about 9 years old when you go home to visit your parents, you revert to total subordination when you are in the presence of your former CEO. John Goodfriend was still the king of Wall Street, and I was still a geek. He spoke in declarative statements. I spoke in questions. But as he spoke, my eyes kept drifting to his hands. His alarmingly thick and meaty hands. They weren't the hands of a soft Wall Street banker, but of a boxer. I looked up. The boxer was smiling, though it was less a smile than a placeholder expression. And he was saying, very deliberately, "Your fucking book." I smiled back, though it wasn't quite a smile. "Why did you ask me to lunch?" he asked, though pleasantly. He was genuinely curious. You can't really tell someone that you asked him to lunch to let him know that you didn't think of him as evil. Nor can you tell him that you asked him to lunch because you thought you could trace the biggest financial crisis in the history of the world back to a decision he had made. John Goodfriend had done violence to the Wall Street social order and got himself dubbed the King of Wall Street when, in 1981, he'd turned Salomon Brothers from a private partnership into Wall Street's first public corporation. He'd ignored the outrage of Solomon's retired partners. I was disgusted by his materialism. William Solomon, the son of one of the firm's founders who had made Goodfriend CEO only after he'd promised never to sell the firm, had told me. He'd lifted a giant middle finger in the direction of the moral disapproval of his fellow Wall Street CEOs. And he'd seized the day. He and the other partners not only made a quick killing, they transferred the ultimate financial risk from themselves to their shareholders. It didn't, in the end, make a great deal of sense for the shareholders. One share of Salomon Brothers, purchased when I arrived on the trading floor in 1986, at a then market price of $42, would be worth 2.26 shares of Citigroup today, which, on the first day of trading in 2010, had a combined market value of $7.48. But it made fantastic sense for the bond traders. But from that moment, the Wall Street firm became a black box. The shareholders who financed the risk-taking had no real understanding of what the risk-takers were doing. And as the risk-taking grew ever more complex, their understanding diminished. All that was clear was that the profits to be had from smart people making complicated bets overwhelmed anything that could be had from servicing customers or allocating capital to productive enterprise. The customers became, oddly, beside the point. Is it any wonder that mistrust of the sellers by the buyers in the bond market had reached the point where the buyers could not see a get-rich-quick scheme when a seller, Greg Lipman, offered it to them? In the late 1980s and early 1990s, Salomon Brothers had entire years, great years, in which five proprietary traders, the intellectual forefathers of Howie Hubler, generated more than the firm's annual profits, which is to say that the firm's 10,000 or so other employees, as a group, lost money. The moment Salomon Brothers demonstrated the potential gains to be had from turning an investment bank into a public corporation and leveraging its balance sheet with exotic risks, the psychological foundations of Wall Street shifted from trust to blind faith. No investment bank owned by its employees would have leveraged itself 35-1 or bought and held $50 billion in mezzanine CDOs. I doubt any partnership would have sought to game the rating agencies or leapt into bed with loan sharks, or even allowed mezzanine CDOs to be sold to its customers. The short-term expected gain would not have justified the long-term expected loss. No partnership, for that matter, would have hired me, or anyone remotely like me. Was there ever any correlation between an ability to get into and out of Princeton and a talent for taking financial risk? At the top of Charlie Ledley's list of concerns, after Cornwall Capital had laid its bets against subprime loans, was that the powers that be might step in at any time to prevent individual American subprime mortgage borrowers from failing. The powers that be never did that, of course. Instead, they stepped in to prevent the failure of the big Wall Street firms that had contrived to bankrupt themselves by making a lot of dumb bets on subprime borrowers. After Bear Stearns failed, the government encouraged J.P. Morgan to buy it by offering a knockdown price and guaranteeing Bear Stearns' shakiest assets. Bear Stearns' bondholders were made whole, and its stockholders lost most of their money. Then came the collapse of the government-sponsored entities Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, both promptly nationalized. Management was replaced, shareholders badly diluted, and creditors left intact but with some uncertainty. Next came Lehman Brothers, which was simply allowed to go bankrupt, whereupon things became even more complicated. At first, the Treasury and the Federal Reserve claimed they had allowed Lehman to fail to send the signal that recklessly managed Wall Street firms did not all come with government guarantees. But then, when all hell broke loose and the market froze and people started saying that letting Lehman fail was a dumb thing to have done, they changed their story and claimed they lacked the legal authority to rescue Lehman. But then AIG failed a few days later, or tried to, before the Federal Reserve extended it a loan of $85 billion, soon increased to $180 billion, to cover the losses from its bets on subprime mortgage bonds. This time the Treasury charged a lot for the loans and took most of the equity. Washington Mutual followed and was unceremoniously seized by the Treasury, wiping out both its creditors and its shareholders entirely. And then Wachovia failed, and the Treasury and FDIC encouraged Citigroup to buy it, again at a knockdown price and with a guarantee of the bad assets. The people in a position to resolve the financial crisis were, of course, the very same people who had failed to foresee it. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, future Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein, Morgan Stanley CEO John Mack, Citigroup CEO Vikram Pandit, and so on. A few Wall Street CEOs had been fired for their roles in the subprime mortgage catastrophe, but most remained in their jobs, and they, of all people, became important characters operating behind the closed doors, trying to figure out what to do next. With them were a handful of government officials, the same government officials who should have known a lot more about what Wall Street firms were doing back when they were doing it. All shared a distinction. They had proved far less capable of grasping basic truths in the heart of the U.S. financial system than a one-eyed money manager with Asperger's syndrome. By late September 2008, the nation's highest financial official, U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, persuaded the U.S. Congress that he needed $700 billion to buy subprime mortgage assets from banks. Thus was born TARP, which stood for Troubled Asset Relief Program. Once handed the money, Paulson abandoned his promised strategy and instead essentially began giving away billions of dollars to Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and a few others unnaturally selected for survival. For instance, the $13 billion AIG owed to Goldman Sachs as a result of its bet on subprime mortgage loans was paid off in full by the U.S. government, 100 cents on the dollar. These fantastic handouts, plus the implicit government guarantee that came with them, not only prevented Wall Street firms from failing, but spared them from recognizing the losses in their subprime mortgage portfolios. Even so, just weeks after receiving its first $25 billion taxpayer investment, Citigroup returned to the Treasury to confess that, lo, the markets still didn't trust Citigroup to survive. In response, on November 24th, the Treasury granted another $20 billion from TARP and simply guaranteed $306 billion of Citigroup's assets. Treasury didn't ask for a piece of the action, or management changes, or for that matter anything at all, except for a teaspoon of out-of-the-money warrants and preferred stock. The $306 billion guarantee, nearly 2% of U.S. gross domestic product, and roughly the combined budgets of the Departments of Agriculture, Education, Energy, Homeland Security, Housing and Urban Development, and Transportation, was presented, undisguised, as a gift. The Treasury didn't ever actually get around to explaining what the crisis was, just that the action was taken in response to Citigroup's, quote, declining stock price. By then, it was clear that $700 billion was a sum insufficient to grapple with the troubled assets acquired over the previous few years by Wall Street bond traders. That's when the U.S. Federal Reserve took the shocking and unprecedented step of buying bad subprime mortgage bonds directly from the banks. By early 2009, the risks and losses associated with more than $1 trillion worth of bad investments were transferred from big Wall Street firms to the U.S. taxpayer. Henry Paulson and Timothy Geithner both claimed that the chaos and panic caused by the failure of Lehman Brothers proved to them that the system could not tolerate the chaotic failure of another big financial firm. They further claimed, albeit not until months after the fact, that they had lacked the legal authority to wind down giant financial firms in an orderly manner, that is, to put a bankrupt bank out of business. Yet even a year later, they would have done very little to acquire that power. This was curious, as they obviously weren't shy about asking for power. The events on Wall Street in 2008 were soon reframed, not just by Wall Street leaders, but also by both the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve as a, quote, crisis in confidence, a simple old-fashioned financial panic triggered by the failure of Lehman Brothers. By August 2009, the president of Goldman Sachs, Gary Cohn, even claimed publicly that Goldman Sachs had never actually needed government help, as Goldman had been strong enough to withstand any temporary panic. But there's a difference between an old-fashioned financial panic and what happened on Wall Street in 2008. In an old-fashioned panic, perception creates its own reality. Someone shouts fire in a crowded theater, and the audience crushes each other to death in its rush for the exits. On Wall Street in 2008, the reality finally overwhelmed perceptions. A crowded theater burned down with a lot of people still in their seats. Every major firm on Wall Street was either bankrupt or fatally intertwined with a bankrupt system. The problem wasn't that Lehman Brothers had been allowed to fail. The problem was that Lehman Brothers had been allowed to succeed. This new regime, free money for capitalists, free markets for everyone else, plus the more or less instant rewriting of financial history, vexed all sorts of people, but few were as enthusiastically vexed as Steve Eisman. The world's most powerful and most highly paid financiers had been entirely discredited. Without government intervention, every single one of them would have lost his job. And yet those same financiers were using the government to enrich themselves. I can understand why Goldman Sachs would want to be included in the conversation about what to do about Wall Street, he said. What I can't understand is why anyone would listen to them. In Eisman's view, the unwillingness of the U.S. government to allow the bankers to fail was less a solution than a symptom of a still deeply dysfunctional financial system. The problem wasn't that the banks were, in and of themselves, critical to the success of the U.S. economy. The problem, he felt certain, was that some gargantuan unknown dollar amount of credit default swaps had been bought and sold on every one of them. There's no limit to the risk in the market, he said. A bank with a market capitalization of $1 billion might have $1 trillion worth of credit default swaps outstanding. No one knows how many there are, and no one knows where they are. The failure of, say, Citigroup might be economically tolerable. It would trigger losses to Citigroup shareholders, bondholders, and employees, but the sums involved were known to all. Citigroup's failure, however, would also trigger the payoff of a massive bet of unknown dimensions, from people who had sold credit default swaps on Citigroup to those who had bought them. This was yet another consequence of turning Wall Street partnerships into public corporations, to turn them into objects of speculation. It was no longer the social and economic relevance of a bank that rendered it too big to fail, but the number of side bets that had been made upon it. At some point I could not help but ask John Goodfriend about his biggest and most fateful act. Combing through the rubble of the avalanche, the decision to turn the Wall Street partnership into a public corporation looked a lot like the first pebble kicked off the top of the hill. "Yes," he said, "they, the heads of the other Wall Street firms, all said what an awful thing it was to go public, and how could you do such a thing? But when the temptation rose, they all gave in to it." He agreed, though, the main effect of turning a partnership into a corporation was to transfer the financial risk to the shareholders. "When things go wrong, it's their problem," he said, "and obviously not theirs alone. When the Wall Street Investment Bank screwed up badly enough, its risks became the problem of the United States government." "It's laissez-faire until you get in deep shit," he said with a half-chuckle. He was out of the game. It was now all someone else's fault. He watched me curiously as I scribbled down his words. "What's this for?" he asked. I told him that I thought it might be worth revisiting the world I'd described in Liar's Poker now that it was finally dying. Maybe bring out a 20th anniversary edition. "That's nauseating," he said. Hard as it was for him to enjoy my company, it was harder for me not to enjoy his. He was still tough, straight, and blunt as a butcher. He'd helped to create a monster, but he still had in him a lot of the old Wall Street, where people said things like, "A man's word is his bond." On that Wall Street, people didn't walk out of their firms and cause trouble for their former bosses by writing a book about them. "No," he said, "I think we can agree about this. Your fucking book destroyed my career, and it made yours." With that, the former king of a former Wall Street lifted the plate that held his appetizer and asked, sweetly, "Would you like a deviled egg?" Until that moment, I hadn't paid much attention to what he'd been eating. Now I saw he'd ordered the best thing in the house, this gorgeous, frothy confection of an earlier age. Whoever dreamed up the deviled egg? Who knew that a simple egg could be made so complicated and yet so appealing? I reached over and took one. Something for nothing. It never loses its charm.
The Big Short by Michael Lewis. In a special interview for this program, the author spoke with Simon & Schuster about The Big Short.
The story of the subprime mortgage crisis is in part a story of how thoroughly people, even very smart people, can deceive themselves if they're paid to do so. In some ways, the whole industry had become a giant Ponzi scheme. The industry is meant to allocate capital. It's meant to be a handmaiden to actual productive enterprise. It is not in and of itself productive enterprise. And it became this beast on the side of the economy that had very little to do with the rest of the economy. Most of its profits came from speculative trading and in markets that were of negative social value. I mean, the subprime mortgage market, which got very big very quickly and was the most profitable department in all these firms for several years, was a machine for destroying capital. It was not a machine for putting it where it was supposed to go to make us all wealthier in the long term. It was a machine for putting it in exactly the wrong place. So I think that what's happened, this crisis on Wall Street, is different from the previous ones, and it has led a lot of intelligent people to question the assumption that markets always know best, and that whatever is happening on Wall Street must be for the general good. It's so obviously not true that it begs a political and social response, and we're still working through that. Two big questions about the bailout as it happened. The first is the simple economic question. Are we all better off now for the government having done what it did than we would have been if they just let nature take its course? Nature taking its course, all these firms would be out of business. And there would have been a great catastrophe. And it is true we would be living in a depression right now. The problem is that they frame the problem. It was either or. It was let nature take its course or this sort of full on prop up, not just the system, but all these people who caused the problem in the first place. And the people in the Treasury never pursued aggressively the power to force one of these firms into receivership and wind them down in a less chaotic way. I think that that would have been a more equitable solution. It brings me to sort of like the second question, and that's the political side of all this. We're now living in a perverse world where the Obama administration is essentially paying the price for being the friend of Wall Street. That's insane. But they brought this on themselves. They took the decision, I think, that it was politically unacceptable to force all these firms into receivership, to essentially dramatically restructure the financial system. That if they did that, they would be spending all their political capital on the Wall Street problem, leaving them none for everything else they wanted to do. So they, in effect, shove the Wall Street problem onto a back burner so they could get healthcare reform and other things they wanted. In retrospect, I think that looks like a terrible mistake. At the time, I thought it was a mistake, but I didn't know. Now it's looking more and more like it was a mistake. I think they did have the political capital to be very aggressive with the Wall Street firms. They would have infuriated an awful lot of people, but it would have been politically very popular, and it would have empowered them to do other things, I think. So there were two sets of judgments being made. One, what is the economically sort of efficient solution, the least bad choice? And second was, what's the politically best solution, least bad choice? And the politics sort of boxed them in. Once they decided that they couldn't put these firms out of business in a orderly way, they were left with basically no other choice but to kind of gift them money until they got back on their feet. And that's what we're doing now. Our government is gifting huge sums of money to Wall Street firms, much of which is being paid out in huge bonuses to Wall Street people who created the problem we're in because they fear the consequences of not doing that. There's a kind of insanity to it now. But I think a lot of people see that. So there's some next act that's about to happen. What's likely to happen is what Paul Volcker is agitating for now, which seems like it's an outlier kind of position, but it's the most sensible one. And it's to separate speculative trading from ordinary banking, essentially to reimpose Glass-Steagall so that institutions that are vital to the American economy are not engaged in esoteric speculative trading. And what's also, I think, likely to happen is that the speculative trading is more likely to occur inside a partnership structure. The kind of things that Goldman Sachs is doing right now, 5 years from now, is more likely to happen inside just hedge funds. And Goldman Sachs or whatever remains of Goldman Sachs will look more like a big commercial bank, because that's what it's supposed to be now. So I think that the Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley is the couple that are sort of left. They call themselves commercial banks, but their heritage is investment banking. That they're going to look like duller enterprises. And the sexy stuff is outside. And you kind of see this happening already. You see people, a lot of top flight people at these places leaving to go to the other places. And so I think that the change is already underway and the politics is going to shift to accelerate it. The three heroes of the book, the people at Front Point Capital, Steve Eisman and Vincent Daniel and Danny Moses especially, and then there's Mike Berry at Cyan Capital, and then the boys at Cornwall Capital. Eisman and Vinny and Danny are all still thriving at Front Point Capital. However, Front Point is now wholly owned by Morgan Stanley. There's no way that Morgan Stanley is in the future going to be in the business of owning hedge funds. So there's something has to happen there. Their returns have been great. They were just named Hedge Fund of the Year by the big hedge fund magazine. So they've been doing very well. They are personally very unsettled by the economy. They think that there's another great reckoning ahead of us because we haven't reckoned with it yet. And so they've got some cognitive dissonance in their trading. They own things that have gone up that they actually wouldn't own if they weren't making political judgments. But they're thriving. Mike Berry at Cyan Capital has abandoned investing. I mean, I think he was so distraught by being punished for being right in such a big way that he lost interest in running other people's money, that he found that you couldn't stand up against the madness and and be vindicated and celebrated, that you, if you stood up against the madness, you were vilified. And so he's lost his taste for this. He's actually, he's still living in San Jose, California. He made a whole, they all made a whole bunch of money. He's investing, what he told me recently, he's bought some almond farms. It's a fancy way to essentially invest long-term in water. They require a lot of water to grow. And he's got a very complicated argument about why these almond farms are a good idea. So I trust him. I'm not investing in almond farms, but it sounded intelligent when he was explaining it. And Cornwall Capital, Charlie Ledley, Jamie May, and Ben Hocken, they're still together. They all got shockingly rich. They're all more interested in things other than money management. It's kind of an accident that these boys, young men, came together in a garage in Berkeley and formed this hedge fund with 110 grand that then became this $200 or $300 million enterprise. And they're all trying to figure out how to lead meaningful and socially useful lives. And Charlie just told me today that his main interest is not running money. It's actually public education. And he's thinking about leaving to focus entirely on public education. They're stumbling into second acts, is what's happening, that are not going to be financial acts, I suspect. Greg Lippman is still at Deutsche Bank trading. I don't know how far much longer, but he's still at Deutsche Bank trading. Howie Hubler, the man who lost $9 billion at Morgan Stanley, is in hiding in Rumson, New Jersey. And he's got a little business, but he really doesn't like to talk about what happened at Morgan Stanley. Generally speaking, the people who made huge sums of money doing the wrong thing, making the wrong bets, who should not have gotten rich but who got rich, are laying very low. You're not seeing their names in the paper. They're hiding. And they're just hoping it, this kind of passes and no one notices what they did.
The Big Short by Michael Lewis was read and produced by Jesse Boggs. The associate producer was Michael Noble. I'm Linda Weber. Michael Lewis was recorded at Rieger World Studios in Berkeley, California. This has been a production of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.